The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations present The Eternal Light, a program which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today's program, The Story of Ruth the Moabitess, is the second in this Eternal Light series of four talks by Maurice Samuel, author and lecturer, based on his book, Certain People of the Book. Mr. Samuel.
I came to the opinion many years ago that the Book of Ruth got that name by a copyist's error. It should have been the Book of Naomi. In my opinion, she is the central character, Naomi. I find her more interesting, also more mysterious and attractive than young Ruth, alluring as she is. On a certain day in the barley harvesting season more than 3,000 years ago, three women stood arguing and weeping on the road that led from a village in the land of Moab to the Jordan and the land of Judah. All three women were widows. The two younger ones were the daughters-in-law of the oldest one. That is to say, the oldest one had lost her husband, and the two sons who had been married to the young women. The name of the oldest widow was Naomi, and she was a Jewess, or Israelite. The names of her widowed daughters-in-law were Ruth and Orpah, and they were both Moabitesses. They were not worshippers of the God of Israel. The book of Ruth is one of the shortest in the Bible. It has only four chapters, and the first one reads both like an introduction and an epilogue. We are told how Naomi and her husband Elimelech left the land of Judah in a time of famine and sought refuge in the land of Moab. They and their two sons, their only children, Mahlon and Chilion. And further, how Elimelech and Mahlon and Chilion died, and how the famine had come to an end in Judah, and how Naomi wanted to return to her native city. And this is what we read about the argument on the road. And Naomi said to her daughters-in-law, "Go, return each of you to her mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband." Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, "Nay, but we will return with thee to thy people." And Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? If I should say, I have hope again to have a husband and also to bear sons, would you wait for them till they were grown? Would you shut yourselves off for them and have no husbands? No, my daughters, it grieves me much for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone forth against me." And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law farewell, but Ruth clung to her and said, "Entreat me not to leave thee and to return from following after thee. For whither thou goest, I will go, and where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God my God. Where thou diest, will I die, and there I will be buried. The Lord do so to me and more also, if aught but death part thee and me." These words of Ruth's are among the most famous in secular and sacred literature. We listen to them awed across the interval of 3,000 years, and through the mist of our own tears, we see one returning to her native village, and one going
with Naomi toward the Jordan and the town of Bethlehem, Judah. When they have vanished from our sight, we remain standing and wondering, what was there about Naomi of Bethlehem, the wife of the dead Elimelech and the mother of the dead Mahlon and Chilion, that sank so deep into the hearts of the two young Moabite women? And why did neither of them say a single word to hold her back in Moab, though they, for their part, were prepared to follow her into an alien land, and only one of them was finally dissuaded? I have just said that for me there is something mysterious about old Naomi.
It is the mystery of goodness and of the power to awaken love in others. There is also mystery in the power to love, but it is inferior to the power of awakening love. I will not go into this question now. I will only ask, what made old Naomi so determined to return to her native place that her daughters-in-law did not even try to hold her back? Was she anxious about her old age and afraid of becoming a dependent? No. She knew that as long as her daughters-in-law lived, she would have a love-filled home even if they remarried. Was she suffering from the childhood regression of the old and unhappy? No, she was not the kind to withdraw selfishly from the living into the memory of the dead. Did she want to die among her own and be buried with them? These two Moabite women had become her own, and in the end she would be buried with her own, her husband and her two sons. What then drew her, or drove her so resolutely back to Bethlehem in Judah? Perhaps we have a clue in those words. It grieves me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone forth against me. They are overwhelmingly despondent words. They seem to indicate despair. She wanted to leave her daughters-in-law because
she believed that an evil destiny was attached to her, and they would share it with her if they went with her. Therefore, she told them to turn back. But Ruth would not be deterred. Then we read that when Naomi and Ruth arrived in Bethlehem,
all the city was astir concerning them, and the women said, "Is this Naomi?" And she answered them, "Call me not Naomi," which is the Hebrew for pleasant. "Call me Mara," that is bitter. "For the Lord hath dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full, and the Lord hath brought me back home empty." In this first chapter, Naomi is almost like a female Job. And now the two widows, a mother-in-law and daughter-in-law, have settled in Bethlehem. How were they going to live? We are told that Naomi had a tiny property left her by her husband Elimelech. But there was no income attached to it. Naomi also had relatives by marriage. One of them, Boaz, was rich and important. Another, whose name is discreetly left out, was also a man of some means. I am ashamed to say that neither of these relatives called on Naomi or inquired after her welfare. They must have known of her return. All the city was astir concerning them. Their well-to-do relatives ignored them. Now we read, "And Ruth the Moabitess said unto Naomi, Let me go into the field and glean among the ears of corn after him in whose eyes I shall find favor. And Naomi said unto her, Go, my daughter." Notice, Naomi did not tell her to go to Boaz's field or the field of the other well-to-do relative. She simply said, "Go, my daughter." The widow and the stranger were entitled by law to go into any field and to pick up the ears of grain dropped by the reapers or left standing in the corners of the field. That was the social security system in ancient Judea, the earliest known in history. But there is hardly any doubt that Naomi was hoping that Ruth would light by chance on Boaz's field. She was thinking not only of a livelihood for herself and Ruth, she was thinking of a husband for Ruth. And so it turned out. We read that Ruth went and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and her hap was to light on the portion of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech, Naomi's dead husband. And Boaz noticed her and asked the foreman who she was, and the foreman answered, "It is a Moabitish damsel who came back with Naomi." Thereupon Boaz approached Ruth, and there was a conversation between them, in the course of which Boaz said, "It has been fully told me all that thou hast done unto thy mother-in-law after the death of thy husband, and how thou hast left thy father and thy mother and the land of thy birth, and art come into a people that thou knowest not heretofore. The Lord recompense thy work, and be thy reward complete from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings thou art come to take shelter." I must say that this little speech of Boaz is so pious and so ingratiating, doesn't make a good impression on me. At last it is clear, beyond doubt, that he knew all about Naomi's and Ruth's return, yet he had never made an effort to look them up. He hadn't even sent them a parcel of food anonymously. But one might suspect that he was a trifle scared by the arrival in town of his poor relatives. It wasn't until he had seen Ruth that he began to feel nobly about her. We have to suppose that Ruth was a very beautiful young woman, and the tradition supports that view enthusiastically. And once he had got to know her, his attentions became very marked for a time. We read, "Boaz said to her at mealtime, 'Come hither and eat of the bread and dip thy morsel in the vinegar.' And after the meal, Boaz openly and unembarrassed said to the young men who were harvesting, 'Let her glean even among the sheaves, and put her not to shame. And also pull out for her from the bundles, and leave it, and let her glean, and do not rebuke her.'" He was making up to her for his neglect, and we can imagine that it occasioned not a little gossip. Boaz, the wealthy landowner, and the Moabitish girl. By that evening, it must have been all over town. The whispering on the rooftops and before the doorsteps, the speculation and the envy and perhaps the malice. Boaz, the catch of the town. More than one mother with a marriageable daughter must have had her eyes on him. And on that same evening, when Ruth came home to Naomi, carrying a whole ephah of barley, which is over a bushel, Naomi was astonished. It was obvious that Ruth couldn't have gathered more than a bushel just by gleaning for one day. Someone must have thrown down stuff especially for her. "Where hast thou gleaned today? Blessed be he that took knowledge of thee." And Ruth answered, "The name of the man was Boaz." Boaz. The name meant nothing to Ruth. She had no idea that he was of her husband's family. She saw no special significance in it, except that the man had been interested and kind. But to old Naomi, it was like the finger of God. To her, it was not a coincidence, but a sign from heaven that the evil destiny which had pursued her till then was about to drop away, and she was to know happiness. And it is as well to note that the happiness that Naomi dreamed of was to spring from the happiness of Ruth. Well then, Naomi had received a sign. There was an immediate change in her outlook. When her wealthy kinsmen had ignored her, she had said nothing about them to Ruth, although she must have said to herself, "So this is how matters stand." But But when Ruth came home with the bushel of barley and the story of Boaz's attentiveness, she must have said to herself, "So this is how matters stand." But all she said to Ruth was, "The man is a close relative of ours. And it is good, my daughter, that thou go out with his maidens and that thou be not met in another field." Old Naomi's mind was at work. A sign from heaven didn't mean to her that everything was going to happen according to her highest wishes and there was nothing for her to do. She had to cooperate. She had to act. But how? When? We are going to discover that Naomi had an exquisite sense of timing. An ordinary woman might have acted prematurely or might not have acted at all. Not so with Naomi. She waited for the right moment. The weeks went by and the reapers reaped and the gleaners gleaned. And every evening Ruth brought home her gleanings and not a word more from or about Boaz. Was he sorry he had been so precipitate? He, the mature man? Was he afraid that young Ruth would not take him? We don't know, because we aren't told. There had been an exciting start, big with promise, and no follow-up. He had shown such friendliness on the first day, and now silence. And Naomi must have said again, "So this is how matters stand." In order not to be too hard on Boaz, we must recall that there were certain laws in ancient Judea which affected the situation. If a woman became a widow, the brother of her dead husband was morally bound to marry her. If he refused to do that, he had to submit to a humiliating ceremony. He had to appear in public. The woman took off one of his shoes and spat on the ground in contempt. Before this ceremony, called chalitza, had been performed, the woman wasn't free to marry again. Now, it so happened that Naomi's other relative, who would also be Ruth's relative, was nearer in kinship to her than Boaz. It is not stated that he was a brother of Ruth's dead husband. That would have made him a son of Naomi's. But it seems that he was of sufficiently close kin to come under the application of the chalitza law. Boaz couldn't marry Ruth until this unnamed relative had released her. And it is possible that Boaz hesitated so long because he was not at all sure that the other relative would release Ruth. But the harvest days were ending. After them, Boaz would hardly ever see Ruth, if at all. True, he wasn't by any means Ruth's last chance. But in Naomi's judgment after the sign, this was the marriage for Ruth. We who live so long after the event can see that Ruth and Boaz were meant for each other. But those who lived through the event hadn't our advantage. The time had come for old Naomi to act. We read, "And Naomi said unto Ruth, Behold, Boaz will be winnowing barley tonight on the threshing floor. Wash thyself, therefore, and anoint thyself, and put thy best raiment on thee, and get thee down to the threshing floor. But do not make thyself known to Boaz until he shall have finished eating and drinking. Then, when he lieth down, mark the place, and go to him, and uncover his feet, and lie down there, and he will tell thee what thou shalt do." We know so little about the customs of those days that we can't determine how much boldness there was in Naomi's counsel and how much convention. We can rule out at once any suggestion of impropriety. That would be grossly out of keeping with our characters and with the story. What we do know is that Ruth followed Naomi's instructions to the letter. And in the middle of the night, Boaz awoke and a woman was lying at his feet. And he said, "Who art thou?" And she answered, "I am Ruth, thy handmaid. Spread thy skirt, therefore, over thy handmaid, for thou art a near kinsman." To which Boaz replied, "Blessed art thou of the Lord, my daughter, that thou hast shown more kindness in the end than at the beginning, for thou didst not follow the young men, rich or poor. And now, my daughter, fear not. I will do all that thou sayest, for all the men in the gate of my people know that thou art a virtuous woman." This man, Boaz, really had an unfortunate way of expressing himself. When he first met Ruth, he said, "It hath been fully told me all that thou hast done unto thy mother-in-law, and the Lord recompense thy work." And now he tells her, "For all the men in the gate of my people know that thou art a virtuous woman." It looks as though he had been waiting for public approval before he decided to act. Perhaps I am doing him an injustice. What looks like offensive caution may only have been an elderly man's awkwardness. The important thing is that he promised to act the next day, and he did. We read, "Now Boaz went up to the gate and sat him down there, and the near kinsman came by, and Boaz said to him, 'Oh, such a one, turn aside, sit down here.'" Such a one. Not a very courteous way of addressing a man. But the man wasn't the kind to inspire respect, as we shall see in a moment. We read, "And Boaz took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, 'Sit ye down here.' And he said to the kinsman, 'Naomi, that is come back out of the field of Moab, selleth the parcel of land which was our brother Elimelech's. And I thought to disclose it unto thee, saying, buy it in the presence of them that sit here. If thou wilt redeem it, redeem it. But if thou wilt not redeem it, then tell me that I may know. For there is none to redeem it beside thee, and I am after thee.'" Then such a one, or as we would say nowadays, what's his name, answered, "I will redeem it." He was willing to buy the parcel of land so that it should remain in the family. But he'd forgotten something. And Boaz reminded him, saying, "On the day when you buy that parcel of land from Naomi, you are also buying it from Ruth, the Moabitess. And to buy it, you must marry her, so that she may have children to commemorate her dead husband." Thereupon such a one immediately backed down. He said, "I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I mar my own inheritance." What did he mean? Just a moment ago, he was ready to acquire the piece of land, and now that he heard he could only do so by marrying Ruth, he found it didn't pay. The legends tell us that such a one, they give him the name of Tob, I don't know why, didn't know the law. He supposed that Ruth, being a Moabitish woman, wouldn't be protected by that law. And the moment he found out that this law, like the law of gleaning, applied to strangers just as much as to Israelites, he changed his mind. He cuts a rather sorry figure. He wanted the land, and what happened to Ruth afterwards was none of his business. It was of this kind of man that in later years the prophet would say, "Woe to those that join house to house, that lay field to field." Let's dismiss him from the story. He introduces a jarring note. For now the story rises to a grand choral climax. We read, "And Boaz said unto the elders and unto all the people, ye are witnesses this day that I have bought all that was Elimelech's and all that was Mahlon and Chilion's from the hand of Naomi. Moreover, Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of Mahlon, have I acquired to be my wife, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance, that the name of the dead be not cut off from among his brethren and from the gate of his place. Ye are the witnesses this day. And all the people that were in the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses. The Lord make the woman that is to come into thy house like Rachel and like Leah, which too did build the house of Israel, and do thou worthily in Ephrat, and be famous in Bethlehem. Boaz has therefore taken it upon himself to be the surrogate of the dead man, and to be known forever, therefore, as the husband of Ruth the Moabitess. He was to be famous, but only as the husband of Ruth. We who read so much today about husbands and won't accept a secondary role to a great or gifted woman must acknowledge that there was a fine modesty in Boaz. He knew himself to be the less important person and was willing to accept that role. And at this point we feel that the idyll of old times is ended. Ruth the Moabitess has found a fine husband. Naomi will be taken care of for the rest of her days. But just at this point, when it is ending, the story takes the strangest turn imaginable in the last few sentences. We read, so Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son, and the women said unto Naomi, blessed be the Lord who hath left thee not without a kinsman, and let his name be famous in Israel, and he shall be unto thee a restorer of life and a nourisher of thine old age. For thy daughter-in-law, who is better to thee than seven sons, hath borne him. And Naomi took the child and laid it in her bosom, saying, there is a son born to Naomi. And they called his name Obed. He is the father of Jesse, the father of David. How extraordinary. Is not this the book of Ruth? And does it not celebrate primarily Ruth's sweetness and devotion? Naomi certainly plays an important part, but how can the book end so strangely with Naomi at the center of the epilogue and Ruth somewhere at the side? So much so that the women say, there is a son born to Naomi, as though the great-great-grandmother of David were Naomi and not Ruth. We get the feeling that the recorder of the story originally thought of Ruth, the more obviously dramatic of the two women, as the heroine, and that is how he tried to write it. And certainly Ruth is one of the loveliest and most moving characters known to us. But as he went along, Naomi, with whom the story opens, drew him more and more,
even as she had drawn her daughters-in-law, and he was not quite aware of it, and by the time he ended, he had forgotten what he started out to say. He was, in fact, a greater artist than he intended to be. We are told that the story of Ruth and Naomi was written as a protest against Jewish chauvinism. Someone recalled it or thought it up at a much later period in the days of Ezra the scribe, when he was compelling the Jews of his time to divorce their foreign and idolatrous wives. I don't accept this view, but I honor it and recognize the points in its favor. It is pleasant to observe how often the text insists on Ruth the Moabitess. There is no glossing over of her origins. And if with all this in its favor, I reject the theory of a propaganda piece, it is because I do not believe that such great writing can be born of a public relations assignment. It was a spontaneous recording by a man who was a greater artist than he knew.
just heard the second in this Eternal Light series of four talks by Maurice Samuel, author and lecturer, based on his book, Certain People of the Book, published by Alfred A. Knopf, Incorporated. Be with us again next week for the third program in this Eternal Light series, The Story of Isaac and Rebecca. The Eternal Light is produced under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This pre-recorded program has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation.
This is the NBC Radio Network.